It is Saturday, March 15th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the Central Coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org.
Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Mira Software Services, 1,500 software professionals specializing in the areas of software-defined networking, evolved packet core, and more. Details at mera.biz or 650-479-5350.
It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the Geek's affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the studio with me is Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie. Morning, Miles.
Good morning.
So, Miles, let's roll off the first news story with a little bit about Google Glass, because I love it and wear it all the time because I'm insane.
Something that I saw as a usage recently was ER doctors using Google Glass and using the two-dimensional barcodes, the QR codes, to identify patients, get their histories, things like that. And I was thinking about it in terms of the back and forth with regard to people being assaulted in bars because they have Google Glass. The visual, I guess you might even say ostentatious aspect of that device, that it's very recognizable. Yeah. And it gives people the heebie-jeebies if they don't have intimate knowledge of the device, like when the light turns on to know that you're recording, or how long it could actually record so that it's not something that someone wouldn't be spying 24 hours a day because the battery just wouldn't last that long, that type of thing. But in the setting of a medical facility, I personally was thinking, and I was talking with Dr. Don.
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi, how are you doing? Good. I decided I had to put my two cents in here.
Right, and was thinking that in a diagnostic environment, like it just looks like another piece of equipment, just like a stethoscope or the like, where it wouldn't be intimidating because I want the doctor to look at me.
Yeah.
When I was a little doctor, they taught me to use that mirror on the head thing and a bright light to look at. And that was kind of the classic stereotypical doctor, right? Wearing the mirror on the head.
A doctor.
Well, there is a bit of a costume aspect of being a doctor, right? You're coming in and being a professional. You have your white coat on. And part of that is about putting somebody at ease, right? You don't want to look like you've just rolled out of bed.
Well, there's that. And I think also there's kind of a ritualistic quality to medicine. And also it's a little bit of, always reminded me of like a priest putting on the chasuble. There's some interesting psychological stuff going on in terms of that. Or when you don't wear it, when you show up in blue jeans and Birkenstocks, and or the, you know, hey, I'm the cool free clinic doctor. I mean, it's a different vibe. But getting back to the Google Glass, yeah. Now that we've moved to electronic medical records, once we've gone through the incredible frustration of learning a system and putting all the data in there. It's one of the big complaints people have is that the doctor is glued to the computer. They're not looking at the patient. They're hunched over and chimping and, you know, basically sure. Clicking on a keyboard. That doesn't feel like a good relationship. So I'm kind of weighing, okay, the dehumanization of Google Glass, which, you know, it puts a barrier, mm-hmm. but there's already a barrier.
Yeah.
And it's better to make eye contact and then look up to the right and look at the person's med list than it is to turn around or turn down and look at a computer. That is less disengaging. So I want it, you know.
Yeah.
But I also want it to be able to talk to
all your medical systems,
software.
Right?
I'd like all the, actually, what I want from Santa is I want the hospital system to talk to my office system, and I want both of our systems to talk to Palo Alto Medical Foundation's system, and I want them to all speak to each other. Clearly, as
that's
computer
not happening.
Session. Oh, not even close.
Which is not an issue with the device you use. That's more of an issue of the infrastructure that exists.
Just it, Well, yeah. That's an issue with, how the playing field was defined by the people who make the laws, who could have regulated it such that we had interoperability, but for whatever reason, we're lobbied out of it.
You know, there's one aspect about Google Glass and the medical space. If you came in and were treating me and you had glass and I didn't, and you were looking at information about it, it's very personal. It's very hard to share it. No one knows what you're looking at. And that's aspect... I'd rather have my doctor show me mm-hmm. what's going on. I like seeing your laptop, because I normally go, what are you looking at? But I do like that aspect. So it feels like having it in the eye up there is less, it's more, it shows more that, what I know is different than what you know. And I don't like that power struggle mm-hmm. exactly.
No, I see what you make a good point there. But how about we project it on the ceiling?
That could work. I mean, I use Google Glass all the time. Yeah. And I think that the prescription scanning would make a lot of sense. Like that you have to duplicate a number or look something up or type something is crazy, right? Like, our devices can scan things and that's what should and give you information about what the medical, what the bottle is. I'm assuming that sometimes somebody will bring in a bottle and you have to look it up, right? You've got to copy a name and sometimes the names are a little strange. So to some degree, that makes sense. I like that a lot. And then the history of the patient at a flip or a couple finger flips does make sense to me.
I invite you, either of you actually, to come to my office and I will show you three different electronic medical records that I still use, and you can laugh your heads off at how bad they are and how insane.
Has the software changed since I did that tour with you?
Only for the worst.
Oh, really? It's
yes.
gotten worse.
It has. It has. Electronic prescription writing is
it was serviceable when I saw it. Like
Miles,
it,
why don't you and I just stop working for the companies we work for? For Google and Netflix, we'll just drop out.
Guys, let's form a consortium and let's do it right. No, what we first what we need is we need the government behind us.
We got the laws.
Anyway, I got to roll, guys.
Right.
Have a great show.
Thank you so much. I'll see you in the office.
When you talk about that distance between the doctor knowing something that you don't when you have glass,
I don't know,
there's also a large part of me that thinks that's already the case with doctors, that they have access to information that you don't have.
Especially when you're talking with Dawn, who's a genius and knows everything. And then you're in a situation like, she knows more than anything I know.
But at the same time, when you have something like Google Glass, or actually any client for that matter, there is nothing preventing the technology to know which client, in other words, the doctor, mm-hmm. who's asking for it, which room they're in, GPS navigation
sure.
or whatever positioning, and having a secondary screen that puts up information that
yeah.
the doctor can see up on the
yeah,
screen.
That's a good idea.
And that's going to be a social thing, like whether or not, because I don't know whether that would work with doctors' workflow or not,
right.
or whether that would be distracting with this, patients.
I've signed up for an app that I'm supposed to investigate my social network and then bring in information about people at meetings that I have. And I actually haven't got it synced correctly. But the idea is that if I've added a calendar and I've added people to my calendar entry, right before the meeting, it would pop up with all the people's names, their most recent tweets, kind of give me a dossier on who I'm about to meet with, which is a really cool idea and something you could imagine a secretary doing, an assistant doing mm-hmm. for you. But of course, it takes a lot of time. I'll do that sometimes when I'm going to a meeting and I don't know some of the people. I'll look them mm-hmm. up real quick. But to have that all automated makes a lot of sense. For a doctor, even more so, right?
Right. But there's still the ick factor that
yeah.
this is... I do agree with you that this is the way things are going. In much the same way as 30 years ago, I'm sure people would be horrified to say, yeah, no one – people have hundreds of phone numbers in their phone, but they don't remember a single one. They barely remember their own.
Right.
And that's just because
and now
they
it's
have
like,
to,
yeah, why would we want to remember numbers? Those are stupid.
Yeah. Like, I remember mine, and I kind of remember my wife's, but she just got a new phone number, so I don't
– yeah. Well, speaking of numbers and humans not being able to memorize numbers, the actual internet connects with numbers, IP numbers. IP version 4 actually is four different sets of numbers with periods in between. And so you've seen them probably when you set up your home network, 192.168.1. Those are called IP addresses. IP version 6 is supposedly coming out at some point, and it's much
no, it's
more complicated.
Out. It's out.
Yeah.
My cable connection gives me an IPv6 address.
Oh, cool. It's just that it's not as ubiquitous as IP version 4. In any case, both of these things the internet wouldn't work the same way if we didn't have a way of translating names for things to these numbers, because we're not very good at memorizing numbers. Mm-hmm. So we have a kind of international address book called the DNS, and I think you spoke about it a bit last week. Dynamic.
Yeah, it was with IPv4. It was bad enough because you had to remember four numbers.
Yeah,
and then suddenly IPv6. It's
you can't remember those numbers. How long are they? They're ridiculous.
Instead of being a 32-bit number, which that's where it comes out, four numbers that are from 0 to 255 altogether, they make 32 bits. Mm-hmm. Just for those who don't get that, just take my word for it.
Good. Thank you. I thought you were going to try to explain it. Don't do that. Go on.
IPv6 is 128 bits. So it's not even twice as big. It's four times as big. So if you had trouble remembering the IP addresses now, just imagine trying to remember four times as many numbers, or 16 numbers in a row from 0 to 255.
So I won't be able to do that with, you know, like I can with IP version 4 numbers. In any case, the way we translate those is the dynamic name services.
Domain name services.
And the domain name system is kind of ubiquitous. It was actually started by the U.S. government. The organization that actually currently runs it is...
And insecure for so many years.
still totally to insecure.
Weak link in
national
internet security.
The group is the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. It's part of the United States Department of Commerce. And they recently, actually on the 14th yesterday, announced that they would hand over the ownership of the system to the community at large, the idea that it wouldn't be a U.S. governmental agency. This means that the underlying structure of how domain names will be assigned and managed and all of that will no longer be a U.S. government organization. By 2015 is their target date, which is kind of cool, pretty soon. And that involves basically having a community come together to define the organization to take it over. And I think part of the reason to do this, it makes sense in my mind that it's not one government. I kind of wish that we had some kind of global organization that could represent that. The UN seems like a natural standard for me, but that doesn't really exactly work.
That's just because that's the one, United Nations, except they're not all
they're
that
four.
United.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So I think the kind of nonprofit NGO kind of way of thinking about it's probably a better way to do it. What's your thought on this?
Well, I actually am taken aback by ICANN was created in 1998. Do you know why it was created specifically in 1998?
No.
Because there was one person who was in charge of managing the root level domain system.
No way.
And he died in 1998.
Oh my gosh.
So they formed an organization to do what this one guy at, I think it was the University of California, Los Angeles.
You said ICANN. It's the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. These are the people that actually do the root names. Now, when we talk about root names, just really quickly, we have .com and .org and .net and .uk, and there's all these root-level domains, and you can add things on top of those. Those have been exploding in the last few years. It's kind of seems ridiculous that they're doing that, because how many names do we actually need? It's really also obvious that the U.S. has a dominance in this play, because there is no .com.us in wide use, even though in the U.K. there's .com.uk
or
.co.uk.
It's because of who created it.
Right. So we kind of, you know, the U.S. com is corporations and orgs is organizations. So it's kind of interesting to see that switch. I'm hoping that if an international market comes along, that country names will become more dominant, in the sense that it makes more sense if there's an organization that's in the United States for it to have some kind of domain that follows that it's in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So one person was managing those root assignments and what could happen. And of course, there was a whole computerized system to do this, but there was one root registry and allocation system run by one person, and he passed away. And that's why ICANN showed up. Interesting. I had no idea that was the story.
Well, back in the day also, and the .com changed things quite a bit, but prior to that, it was probably, what's considered a manageable problem. And after the explosion of the .coms and the infrastructure required to get that probably changed quite a bit. And that probably happened around 1998 anyway.
Yeah. It was actually 97 that DNS, as outlined by the U.S. government, it marks the first privatization of that
95, role. Actually.
95. Oh, 97. Okay. Well, anyway, the dates are not that interesting.
I remember 1995 because that's when I had my Netscape Gold 2.0 beta.
Oh, it's not the domain names existing. It's the privatization of that structure.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So the other thing that's interesting to me, you mentioned the security aspect of domain names and that it's kind of a difficult process. What's been happening now is that we have built into our browsers certifications, but also IP address certifications, meaning that basically Chrome, for example, Google's browser, will know if you try to access a website that's actually not Google's, but the domain name server is saying it's Google's, it actually gets detected. And that's how some kind of rogue DNS services got caught, mm-hmm. where people were putting kind of man-in-the-middle attacks on DNS and SSL. And that was only happening because the actual application that people were running was kind of reporting on the problem. It's actually this issue is kind of complicated.
And over time, the proliferation of secure socket connections has mitigated some of these problems because secure socket communications are the certificates that we talk about from time to time. Don't just say your communication with, like me communicating with my bank is secure. The certificate also states that, yes, and you are also making sure I am talking to my bank.
Yes, that aspect's kind of important.
Yeah, which brought in an exploit that recently came in. It was kind of a mixture of technical and social engineering, taking SSL into account, Lyle.
Yeah, I was going to mention that, but you know, why don't we get to that in a few minutes? We're going to take a quick break. Do stay with us. We'll be taking calls. We've got some more news, a bit about that you just mentioned, also something from Tim Berners-Lee as well. So stay with us here on GeekSpeak. Also on KOSP, East-West Spirituality, the Recovery Movement and the Birth of the Psychedelic Age. Writer Don Latton discusses the overlapping lives of British writer Aldous Huxley, New Age mystic Gerald Harold, and Alcoholics Anonymous founder Bill Wilson. Latton, a former religion reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, also talks about his own addiction and recovery. The show is hosted by KOSP's Robert Pauly. That's the 7th Avenue Project tomorrow here on KOSP. You're listening to Geek Speak on KOSP, and Rick Philman is in the other room waiting for your calls with questions and comments about technology. Toll free, of course, at 1-800-655-5877. This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam. And Miles, what can people see up at geekspeak.org?
What can people's, if I, you know, open up the browser, you mean?
Well, I meant the geek bit of your day, of the day.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay. Yeah, that was cryptic.
I tried.
You will be able to see a description of a binary star recently discovered. Now, binary stars are actually a dime a dozen. They are extremely common out there in the universe, it turns out. But this one is also a hypergiant star. A hypergiant star being
both of them are hypergiant?
No, just one of them. But,
okay.
That's what makes it so interesting and why the pictures are well worth going to the site and taking a look at, which is that the star, and when I say a hypergiant, I'm not kidding. I mean, like,
one of those things that makes our solar system an entire sun, like massive sun.
Take the sun, now multiply its diameter.
Okay.
1,300 times.
That's a big sun. So that we're talking like, yeah, that's massive. Cool.
And it has a binary star that's with it. And that happens from time to time. But what's curious about this is that companion star is actually not that different from our sun. And it's so close that the photosphere of the larger star touches the smaller star.
No way.
So instead of having two distinct stars, you have something that looks rather like a peanut.
Wow, that's pretty cool. All right, for other things to see up at geekspeak.org after we finish the show, of course, we hear stories about drones all the time. It's really kind of fun, and this is also a drone update. This is video footage of a drone flying into an active volcano. And so you see molten stuff flying and showing, you know, throwing around, something that would be very dangerous for a human being. So I recommend taking a look at that video. The DJ Phantom flies into a volcano. All right. You kind of forward promoted the idea of SSL and how it can be taken advantage of sometimes and this new phishing attack. So let me clarify really quickly. A phishing attack is this idea that you can kind of lure somebody in to your site and take their information if you trick them into doing so. That's why it's called phishing. It's kind of like a lure. And what you do is you make a web page that looks a lot like the web page the person wants to go to. So a website that they normally log into a lot, you duplicate every part of it. You put up a form. You put it somewhere else, though. And when they actually go sign into their account using that phishing website, what actually happens if the hackers are really smart, they'll take that information from the user, they'll store it, then they'll submit it to the real site doing exactly what the user wants and return the results. So the person actually never knows that they're being lured into this activity. What we've recommended on GeekSpeak for years is when you go to, don't click on a link in an email. Let's say your bank sends you saying, hey, something's wrong with your account. Don't click on the link because that might be fake. Go to your website like you normally do, Bank of America or Wells Fargo, whatever it is. Coast Commercial. I'm trying to think of some non-giant corporations. Anyway, your bank's website. And that way, at least, you're not being directed there, and therefore, it's probably going to be the website. And then also make sure that the domain name is the actual domain name you're looking for and that there's a little secure lock on it. And that means that the SSL certs are working. So all those things are ways of protecting you. So a recent phishing scheme hit up for targeting your Google Drive account. And people probably, if they've
actually targeting your Google account. That's happened with Facebook and Twitter and Google and others is they've introduced what's known as a federated login service.
Yeah.
Which is you log into one place and then that same login credential, once you've authenticated that you are who you say you are, multiple sites can use that.
Right.
I use that with my Feedly to get news for GeekSpeak, for example, that I log in with Google and Feedly goes like, oh, you've logged in with Google. Okay, you right. are. This is your account.
When I built my Google Glass app, I used that authentication mechanism through Google so that people didn't have to make accounts on my site. They just had to approve that I had access to their system. Same right. type of federation.
And most folks have seen this federated login. Like, for example, when logging into Google, I'm sure many or most of you have seen the one account, all of Google, sign into continue to use Gmail.
Sometimes there's a picture of you on it. Sometimes it's just like a hollow face, depending if it knows what account you're in.
Right. And you put in your email address, your password, you sign in, and you're done. You don't have to log in again.
And I got to say that I do this kind of stuff so much that I have stopped looking at the domain names. I just kind of like, oh, that's probably true. Additionally, I use two-factor authentication with my account, so it would be very hard to spoof me. You'd have to get my phone as well.
Yes.
Which I highly recommend.
So if you haven't done two-factor authentication yet, please do it. I know you may not understand what that means, but take it from the geeks. It's important. Just do it.
Yeah. And
when you
real
get
quickly,
to do
what,
two-factor authentication what, by an organization,
sign up and do
just
it.
Do it.
And then it's a little tricky, but basically two-factor authentication is you need two things to log in. Something you know and something you have is what we normally traditionally have. So we all have our cell phones now, so we can actually install an application on our cell phones that will give us a general number regularly. And then you also have your password. And whenever you need to log in from a new computer, you'd use both those things. That way it's something you know and something you have. It's much less likely that somebody could pretend they're you.
Right. And that two-factor authentication doesn't need to be a smartphone.
Right.
It could be, you know, your candy bar Nokia from 2004.
And the way it works in that situation is you say, I want to log in, and they send you a code through your text message. Your phone receives the text message. It's a four-digit PIN. You enter that in with your password. Presto, bango.
Right.
You're verified.
And it's so much more secure. It's amazingly more secure.
It is a little risky, though, because, of course, to log in from a new system, you have to have that phone. I recently went through a phone activity system where my phone was down and I changed OSs and I lost my. And so you've got to have a backup. So normally when you have two-factor authentication, especially through Google, you can actually print out a whole bunch of one-time use codes and stick them in a folder somewhere. It worked really well for what I needed to do, and I highly recommend
anyway,
you do that. Print
back to the problem.
Back to the hacking phishing thing. What happened is Google also hosts websites, and those websites can be served through HTTPS. So I can put up a new app and website hosted by Google and make a phishing scheme, and the trick there is that if you hit that page, it'll say it's authenticated SSL through Google. That's tricky.
Right. And so when you click on this link, it would take you to something that's on Google.com, and it assumes actually that you're already logged in. So you go to this account, it has a page that looks exactly like the Google login page.
Yeah.
And so you go, oh, well, I just need to log in. And so you type in your email and your password, and and then what it actually is a form that will post that form to another site.
So that they can get the data back out.
Right. And then it redirects you back after it has your email and password. It sends you back to another page on Google Drive that would show you the actual documents you were expecting. So you really don't see anything that's happening.
And the tricky thing about this, because I mentioned it's Google Drive, that the target vector is this. I send an email to you that says, I have a Google Doc document for you. Mm-hmm. You click on that email because you get these kind of things all the time. You show up on a Google page. It says, log in your Google Drive account. You assume, well, that makes sense. I have to do that. In reality, I sent you a link that wasn't Google directory system, it was me on Google's
site. And the same thing could happen with a GitHub
any
account.
Of them. In fact, they probably do.
Yeah.
So you work for Google. Is this being handled? Has this been fixed?
I am not involved in the security apparatus of Google. And if I were, I probably couldn't comment.
That's right.
But at the same time, anything that hits the news
is dealt with.
Yeah. And the thing is, everything that doesn't hit the news is dealt with.
Yeah.
If something does hit the news, like, you can be doubly sure it's going to be fixed. Like, they'll look and see, like, does a page have the same text that ours does?
Right. Just investigate it. And we're not
patterns.
That's the thing about phishing schemes. This is a common thing, is that normally when the page is discovered, it's taken down very quickly because it's clearly made for the purpose of doing the phishing. Mm-hmm. And therefore, there's no other valid way to do it. Google, of course, is in control of that page. It's an account of one of their customers. They can turn it off. So it's not that hard to disable it. What's more interesting is that in later practice, something should be put in place so that it can't be done again.
Right.
And that's tricky.
Yeah. And for the short term, if you want to just be a little more vigilant, when you click on a link and it gives you the Google login page, I'm just going to bring this one up because it's the one that's in the news story. Look at the top. Does it say accounts.google.com? Because if it doesn't,
It's not right.
Yeah.
The other thing to note is that when someone shares a doc with you in your Google account through Google Drive, if you go log into Google Drive and you click shared with me, it'll show up there. So you don't actually have to click on their email thing, assuming they use the right email address for your account. Anyway, I feel like we've been talking way too much about Google. Let's talk about Netflix now. No,
just kidding. We're talking about a security
security issue. And phishing attacks are actually kind of complicated. I'm glad that we covered them a bit.
Yeah. Now, and for folks out there, if you ever get hit by one of these phishing attacks, don't feel bad because
oh my gosh, all the time.
They could fool us, and we've been making websites for
since 96.
Yes.
Yes. We just looking at our old websites.
Which brings you up to
Tim Berners-Lee. Go ahead. Tell us about the inventor of the web.
It's the 25th anniversary of the web.
Oh,
of
that's
the,
so cool.
Of the public, yeah,
25
web,
years.
Yeah.
Wow.
In other words, of the first server that went up, not even necessarily the first browser, but or at least graphical browser, but the first server, like the actual web protocol, is 25 years old.
Now, Tim is actually he's one of those geeks that all geeks respect. Like, he's just a cool person. He's got neat ideas. You know, the idea of the hyperlinked web and the idea of that our general knowledge could be shared in this way. It was ingenious, and he acted as well, and he did, and that's pretty cool. But he's calling for a new age kind of thing. He's calling for a movement a bit.
He's calling for an online Magna Carta. And it's funny because I look at some of the U.S. news coverage of this, and it's been Tim Berners-Lee calls for an online Bill of Rights because far too many Americans don't know what the Magna Carta was.
So they had to translate it for us.
But everyone knows what the Bill of Rights is in the U.S. And but he was saying we need a global constitution, a Bill of Rights, and that is saying right now the web is kind of a wild, wild west. And you have different companies and different countries having different privacy rules, different companies within those countries having different privacy rules and privacy practices, uneven enforcement of those rules, and no one knows exactly where to stand, including the companies that are providing the service, let alone the folks who are consuming the service.
Right.
And so one of the things that he has talked about, he got the technical part of it down 25 years ago, although he's been helping with it since, but he's been more and more active in the social aspect of it, the interaction between human beings and that technology rather than just the technological minutiae day to day. And so talking about this has been like, what is acceptable online for a company or a government to do? What should individuals accept in terms of where their information goes and doesn't go? And so if you want to learn more, go to our website. We'll have a link to the article, and that has the link to the article that the article that we link to will link to even more information. So it's just like the web. It's just this clicking around, you find something new. It's like a...
Well, so since we're talking about a call to action to some degree, I'll throw this one in. This week is the Sunshine Week. Sunshine.org is this organization that's to promote transparency in government. And the week of March 16th through the 22nd, this coming week, is all about getting involved in sunshine movement, the idea that we could make a more transparent open government through technology. There's been quite a bit of initiatives in that realm. In fact, we had some participation here in Santa Cruz City or county, I can't recall, of some local investing of software engineers kind of doing a year of developing better systems for government. And so the Sunshine Organization does a great job of this, and there's a whole bunch of information about what's happening this coming week, different talks, different involvement. Of course, all this is available online. There's a lot of transparency in it, so you can follow it on Twitter and all that. It's sunshineweek.org, and of course, I'll link to it at geekspeak.org. So we're going to go ahead and invite more people to call in. We did get one call, and I'll get into that in a second. The phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Of course, we're available online through email. I read all the email that comes in. I don't always respond to all of it, but it's geeks@geekspeak.org. You can visit us at geekspeak.org as well. So, Hal from Santa Cruz, a regular listener, likes the idea of using Google Glass in the doctor's office, and suggested that three years ago, there's a story at MIT using facial recognition software to an ID individual and display it information about that person. That project was the project that then turned into Google Glass. So in some sense, of course, it sounds familiar. Actually, at MIT, it was much less, it was much more a larger project, but Google's, of course, investing a lot of time and energy into it. And the facial recognition stuff is not something that I use on my glass. I don't know if there's even systems that work that well on it. It's a lot of processing power. Google Glass doesn't have that kind of power at this point. And it just also is, talk about creepy, you know? So anyway, thanks for the call, Hal, though. That is the project that spawned Google Glass in some regards. And maybe we should have some founders by Google Glass on the show or something. Maybe later on, though, a couple of years from now when it's not such a hot topic. All right, so you're welcome to call in with questions and comments of technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Now on an update for broadband hate and telco hate. Here on GeekSpeak, we don't actually like these big companies very much. And I just spent probably 4 hours the other day on Comcast tech support going through sales. Ugh, hate it. Hate
which
them.
Follows previous several weeks that I've had with Comcast.
Same thing, right? Last week on right before GeekSpeak, you were arguing with them on the phone. Afterwards, you were just talking to them on the phone about their bill. They couldn't transfer between units. And the things they say to you were so frustrating. We can't do that. And you're like, yeah. You might not be able to at your terminal, you employee, but the company that like owes me money or is doing
yes,
can
and there is
do
someone
that.
Who has the authority to
there
say
is absolutely
that, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so I talked about a map last week. This update is that only one third of U.S. residents, less than one third of U.S. residents, right around a third of U.S. residents have more than. Let's see. Only a third of U.S. a whole third of U.S. residents only have one choice in broadband, or no choice. Mm-hmm. Right? They can't get broadband, or they can only get
and
one
it
provider.
What you consider broadband too?
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you consider 6 megabit DSL to be broadband, then yeah, I have multiple options.
Right. Right.
Or I could have 6, or I could have 50.
Right. So basically, a third have 3 choices for providers, a third have 2 choices for providers, and a full third only have 1 choice. And so when we talk about then, and 1 choice means monopoly, right? If you like in the area that I live in, I do not like this company. I do not like its service. It's horrible. And yet I do want to be connected to the internet at high speeds. So I, tuck my tail between my legs and please give me service and
right.
Here's my money.
And the retort I get from some folks is, well, they're putting in the expertise and they're doing work and they have it. And then why are they spending so much time making sure municipalities can't put it up?
Yes.
Can't put up a competition.
Exactly.
Well, that would be government intervention. But you have a monopoly that's done by the government.
Yeah.
That's sanctioned by the government.
And you've got the amazing tax credits to actually get the infrastructure put out in the first place. Like the reason the cable goes to my house is because of federal grants. Like that's why goes to my house. Anyway, enough of that. Shall we go on to brighter and sunnier things?
Yes, if you have a wonderful internet broadband horror story, please send it our way. Like, if you want, we can not bring your name.
Yeah.
Let's share these stories. And
got off the phone with them after being frustrated. And I rarely get that frustrated. I got frustrated. And I turned to Maggie. I was like, I wish I had, a 500,000 listeners to GeekSpeak. Not 20,000, but like 500,000. Then they'd listen to me. One day I pulled that, the tool out of media. But
I'm sorry. I just have to put this one last tidbit. Remember week or two ago when I got off the phone and I was in a huff because it was like, okay, you're going to transfer this money from they double charged me. I want this money back. Not as a credit. I want the money back. And a week after that, I got a phone call saying, yeah, we're from billing. You owe us $28. I have to admit, I lost it.
You know what? You can't do anything about it. You gotta just pay him.
No, I refuse. I'll go to small claims court with him. Like,
I got into that place too. I was in that space too.
I signed it off. I actually am now in contract, so it's arbitration, I think. But
yeah,
at the same time, I can go like, yeah, the money was there. If I actually owed that, you could have taken it, but somehow I think $300 is more than $28.
Hey, give us a call. We don't have to just talk about our pain with Comcast. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Hey, at least our governmental officials aren't treating us like this, right?
Nice segue. Because we all have been, or I have been, and many other people have been following the news of the NSA spying on U.S., the Edward Snowden leaking all those materials showing that, yes, the NSA has been spying on us and has been, you know, spying on U.S. companies to get the information, whether they were voluntary or not.
Yes.
And there have been several senators, you know, Dianne Feinstein in particular is one that comes to mind.
That's the senator in California.
Has been defending that intelligence apparatus, saying, no, we need that. No, that is acceptable. That is an acceptable trade-off. We have enough oversight that we can decide that this is okay for you, mm-hmm. for the NSA to be doing this to the American public, which they actually said on record in front of the the committee about this, saying, like, no, we don't spy on U.S. citizens.
Right. Total they liar. Lied about it, sure.
Well, it turns out that the CIA has been following a probe by the Senate. The Senate has been looking to the CIA for oversight to make sure they're doing the right thing. CIA has been looking at the Senate to see, like, hey, what are they doing? What are they up to? And the Senate is now up in arms.
Wait, the CIA has been spying on the Senate?
Yes.
Nice.
And specifically, the portion of the Senate that is involved with looking at and evaluating CIA activities.
this sounds like a movie. So,
right.
How did Congress find out about it?
That one I'll have to look up.
When they found out, were they upset?
Yes, they were a little
really?
Upset. Yes.
But even Dianne Feinstein was upset?
Yes, she's actually been leading the charge, saying this is absolutely unacceptable.
Oh, my God.
Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, was saying this is Richard Nixon stuff. It's dangerous to democracy.
They're suggesting that the senators are supporting spying on U.S. citizens.
Right. This is
they're
the
U.S. citizens.
Me, saying like,
there
no,
you go.
Spy on us, but you can spy on all the little people.
Man, this is just a show of hate. I'm just upset at everybody right now. In the air with me is Miles Elam. I'm Lyle Troxell. We're now taking calls from listeners just like you. Scott from Newark, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I have a question. Actually, it's been hours talking to you guys about all the questions I have, but I have an older iPod. And I was just going to replace it. The display went bad on me. Just half the display is gone. I can still read the bottom half.
Mm-hmm.
But I read online that the new one, they've changed the chip in them, and everyone is claiming that the sound quality is way inferior to the earlier versions.
Okay, which version of the iPhone, which version of the iPod do you have?
Oh, God, it's like the 80 gig, I think, really old.
It's got like a spinning hard drive inside it?
Yeah, it does, unfortunately, yeah.
Wow. Okay, so it's just a matter, if the screen's dead now, it's just a matter of time before the hard drive's dead. And this screen's not very big.
It's not the whole screen dead. It's like, I don't know, I didn't remember dropping it, but part of the liquid display is not displaying. And it's just like the upper right-hand fourth of it.
Yeah, sure.
I can still read the bottom.
It's the actual film that attaches to the LCD. It gets degrades over time and slowly lifts, and that's why you're seeing stripes that aren't being rendered. You could get that thing fixed, but not. I wouldn't do that. First off, the sound quality. the sound quality difference between that iPod that you've got and a newer one, a human being won't be able to tell the difference. And in fact, it's probably better. It's probably not true. I think that most...
Really, because everybody is bitching that the sound is just really worse, that it's just washed out. They don't
Do yourself a favor on your sound system, on a sound system, and go to MP3 or not. I think it's mp3.not.com. And what this is going to do is it's going to allow you to do A-B testings on different files, or ABX testing. So A-B testing is, you know, giving you two sources, and ABX testing is you get three sources. You get one source, which you know what it is, second source, which you know what it is, and like one's a wave, one's an MP3, and the third source is one of those two. And you have to figure out which one it is. And human beings can't do that unless you're like superhuman, because we just can't really tell the difference.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. What's that?
Yeah, human beings can't do that for this case.
Yeah, that's the thing is I think that once you kind of understand the limitations of your actual perception, or at least the boundary of your perception, you might as well just play in that boundary front, you know, and enjoy yourself, because you won't necessarily have any improvement over a better sounding system. So investigate that for yourself first. Miles, were you going to say?
Yes, I was going to say I had a device for my iPhone, but I know they made it for the iPod as well. Where if you're concerned about sound quality, there are items that don't take any power. They're just the shape of the device, of a holder. And you would put one of these newer iPods or an iPhone inside of them, and it would do sound amplification and sounds really good without taking any extra power or draining the battery or having to, you know, have something really bulky.
Yeah. I just got to say, like, the current iPod that you buy at the store has an amazing sound fidelity. And the system that's going to be the weakest point in that is going to be the headphones or audio source. And the second weakest is going to be your ear. That's my general perception. So to me, to say I'm going to hold on to something that's years earlier because I think that the technology was better in that. The truth is there's transistors on the output of that. It's a little op amp output chip. It's probably a larger op amp on the older models because everything gets smaller. And I would say that most likely Apple's, you know, reducing the cost pretty substantially, but they do want good sounding quality audio. So it's interesting because this ties right in line with this whole story about what's the musician that just launched a new service about higher quality audio. What I found about audio quality, the biggest difference is compression and how the files are compressed. And so when you go to...
And loudness.
Well, yeah, compression is... When I'm talking about compression, I'm talking about not file compression, but audio compression, which is the loudness factor of music.
Well, that's... Whenever you're listening to an MP3 and you hear... especially if it's a low-quality MP3, if we were to play music on the Geek Speak podcast, you would hear it.
Yeah, because we compress the audio.
Okay, good.
That's an MP3.
On the sound quality issue of it, and I want to get back to just being the geek. Because I looked online, and the display is $29. You always talk about repurposing and reusing.
Yep.
In fact, I wouldn't have a problem spending $29 to get a new display for it.
Yep.
My question actually is, what do you think the level of difficulty is to pop that screen out and put a new one in? I know it takes that special, like, Apple Blue tool thing that...
Yeah, that's just a little, popper. First off, go to iFixit, iFixit.com. They've got these guides on how to open your devices. Now, do they have the old one or not? I don't know if they still have their old guides up, but I know they do. They've got the iPod repair area, and they've got the original iPod, how to open it up, all the different versions. You could second version, first generation, and it has a full step-by-step on how to do it. Everything is there to do what you need
to
do.
You're absolutely right.
But when you do this, when you open that iPod, if you want to keep it, you want to open that iPod and replace the screen, replace the hard drive too. Because it's just a matter of time before the hard drive dies, and you might as well get a better one now.
Really?
Yeah, is it a FireWire or USB?
I looked at that same page you looked at, and that's why I was going to call you guys, because it's, I'm not really into breaking stuff down and putting it back together. And I've done, I made my own computer and stuff, but I've never, soldered and stuff. So, I just don't know how difficult it would be to pop that thing open and replace the screen. Do you think it's a...
It's not that hard. Yeah. You just really want to read the instructions.
Is it a 5 or is it an 8?
Is what a 5 or an 8? On complexity?
On a 1 to 10, is it a...
I would not do it. I've got an electronics degree. I used to take things apart. And the last time I decided, hey, you know what? This power, this thing for my iPhone 4, it was like a hard drive. It was like a case that had a battery in it. The USB port was bad, right? So I spent like 2 hours opening up and resoldering a chip on the, what is it called? Not a through-point hole, but an S, surface mount component. And it was really hard. It was only 4 points. It was really small. And I had all the right tools and all the right lighting. And I had some time. And I did it as like a practice on being patient and not, you know, and reusing tech and all that. And 2 days later, it broke again. And I, you know what? We're well, not making stuff to be repaired.
Yes, at the same time, you're talking about you would either be repairing this or getting rid of it, essentially throwing it away. So at this point, I totally agree you should, you know, pay the $15, whatever, get the... or
the screen?
Yeah, the new screen, and give it a shot. And if it fails...
You're throwing away twice
yeah,
as much.
Yeah, you're throwing away a thing you were going, you were thinking about getting rid of anyway.
I still won't throw it away because it works great in a car because the car radios now display
yeah.
the info on them and you don't need the display on the,
sure,
I,
on sure.
the iPod anymore.
I say go for it. Do it. You should do it. You should go for it because the truth is you'll have a better appreciation of the device and that device is going to be much easier to open than current day iPods. I mean, I've opened now the old stuff. It's not that bad. I'd go for it. But keep in mind that you keep in mind that you're spending your time that way. Like the, it's a choice of what kind of time you spend.
And there is a chance that you could let the smoke escape.
Yeah, that's an electronic euphemism for killing device. You burn up a component when the magic smoke leaves. It doesn't work anymore.
You cannot put it back in.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, good luck with it. Let us know how it goes. I'd love to hear a success on that.
All right. I might end up. I don't know. Do you think they could do it just at the iTunes store is or whatever it is?
Yeah, any company. Yeah, well, I don't know if an Apple store will do it.
Yeah, but an Apple store won't.
They won't do it because they want to sell you new stuff. But any one of those little fix-it places, like in the mall or you know, place that fix components like that, they'll do it. It's like a watch repair. Anybody that can fix a watch can also do this. It's just about small parts and patience and doing the path. So
then it starts getting as expensive as a new iPod. I might as well just buy.
Oh yeah. Right. No, do it yourself.
Thanks for your help.
All right. Good luck. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Yeah, I have to say that I fall victim to this too, this notion of not only saving time, but also I don't want to risk breaking the thing. But I don't know, there's another part of me that says we should be breaking things more often because you can't learn unless you've broken things. Like for every person who's a system administrator, for example, just taking back into the tech realm, there are huge piles of smoldering boxes that they've messed up somewhere along the line, you know, and that's how they became good. That's how they got that comfort level with the technology that they're using. You know, for every programmer that's out there, you know, that's really good, they're, I'm sure if you went back to their volume of code, you found something that was just absolutely horrible and a mess of go-tos. Yeah.
All right, so you want to cover one of these other stories? We're going to take other calls. The phone number is 800-655-5877. We have one offline call, but I want to offer you either of these last stories.
How about we talk about the one that's just coming in from line two?
Okay, great. Yeah.
Talking to people is always more interesting than just parroting out.
All right, well, Rick has not pushed him in, so we'll just suggest that the Senator committee, so from Steve from Washington State, heard that the reason the committee knew that they were their data was compromised, that the most sensitive document disappeared. So there was actually a problem with one of the sensitive documents they were using. It was no longer available, and they investigated it and found out that they'd been spying.
Oh, so in other words, because the CIA was sloppy.
Yes, it's always about sloppiness. You never find out about the genius criminals.
Okay, so here are a couple of things. This is on an environmental tact here. I'm going to talk about two quick things. One is some environmentalists are talking about buying out the U.S. coal industry, $50 billion, like trying to find a whole lot of people to get a fund together to buy out the industry.
Like the Sequoia, what's that organization that goes and buys coastal redwood areas and then doesn't develop them, just basically for protection aspects. $50 billion.
Yeah, to shut them down,
and turn off all the power in half the house in America.
Right, so saying like, please think about this before you really jump in, because that money that you've bought is now sunk into that.
Literally sunk into the ground.
Well, sunk into the ground, but it's also sunk into the equipment and the wages of people, the contracts that you have with all the employees and stuff like that.
It's not the solution, is what you're saying. Going and buying the coal industry so that you can save the environment doesn't actually address the problem.
Well, you could buy the mountain that they were going to bulldoze.
I could imagine seeing
strip mine.
Yeah, sure.
But
the thing is that coal is 50% of U.S. electricity production. So you need to find some way to fill that gap in so that the next time we have a polar vortex come down that you don't have a lot of people without any power and freezing to death. So
yeah. So what's the solution? What's the solution for the energy problem in the United States?
Study math and science and get better with materials technologies so that we can have better battery technology, so we can have better solar technology, and so we can work with mechanical engineers to get more wind farms out there.
All right. So you think wind farms is kind of that?
You displace it. So you displace the existing technology by making the new technology cheaper and more efficient, and that can be done with, like, seeing what the...
You sound like a technical optimist, Miles.
Taxing... externalities like CO2 output, sure. You know, things like that.
You are listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam. We're coming to the close of the show. Miles has one more story. Obviously, he is more prepared on Geek Speak today than I am. One more story before we run out of time, and it's not much time left.
Sure. This is my soapbox. Actually ties in with Dr. Don's stuff, which is new measles cases are showing up in New York City.
Why?
Because people aren't vaccinating. Because people believe that there is autism. Now, I want you to be very clear about this. Measles, mumps, rubella, pertussis, things like that, those kill people, including children. Autism, even if it did affect it, which doesn't kill.
Yeah. And it doesn't. It's not related. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark by David Lawrence and is used with permission. GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3, which means you can reuse our stuff any way you like. Just let them know the geeks say hi. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me was Miles Elam. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at kusp.org. And, of course, you can find out more about what we say on every episode of GeekSpeak up at geekspeak.org. Thanks for listening.